and we turn it into a bunch of digits. And the more modern studios will do it at 96 kilohertz worth of sampling and 24 bits deep, and the traditional past normal digital studio is 16 bits at 48 kilohertz within the studio. And when you hear that live audio, whether you're doing rock and roll or symphonics or at Lincoln Center, it's absolutely amazing in terms of what it sounds like, and you're dealing with the effect of the operator or the audio engineer that's doing the mix for you. Let me let it drop again. The things that we generally do in a control room is we will sweep it and make it as flat as possible, and with an acoustical engineer we'll actually create the environment within the control room or even on a stage where there are no reflections and the audio is absorbed behind you. And that kind of listening environment is absolutely incredible. Now, once we go to decimate it, to bring it down to a slower sample rate for a CD, you begin to change the characteristics. When you go to MP3 or MP4, we've now actually made decisions about what we're going to put in the audio and what's not going to be there because you can't hear it. So there's a lot of variables going on. One of the radio stations that we put together a performance studio, and I've got six 1,500 watt, 1,850 watt amplifiers that are absolutely clean. I can break the windows in the place, and I can make you deaf, but there won't be any distortion with it. It'll be really low. But the problem really is not so much that you have a system that can do that. The problem is the source material and how it got to you. K2LAW, K2GIANT.
Thank you, Eric. Anybody further questions for Eric or any of the above, give me a call. Let us right now. K2IW, the tech man.
Zulu, is this signal any better? If it's not, I'll just fix it.
You were there 80% of the time that time, Rich. You want to give it a try? W2 Bravo Zulu, K2IW.
Let me get... reproduction in the home, you know, today's good flat screen, much what you see in a studio than sound is to what you hear in a studio. As Eric was saying, I used to know a producer who would put sound in the studio, then mix it down so it sounded as good as possible on a little radio. And until that happened, he wouldn't, you know, say the session was over. Anyway, once you hear either sound in a studio or see color or see TV in a studio, it, quote-unquote, ruins you forever. W2BZ.
Let me add something to what he was saying. I got the drift of what he was saying.
You got it, Eric.
In the older days, when... we did distribution on media as opposed to electronic media, so to speak. The recording engineer, especially stuff that was going to get played on the radio or TV, we would actually do the final mix and listen to them through these things called autotones, and they still use them. They're basically four-inch speakers. They have a really good response over their range. They're not flat, they're kind of bumpy, but they reflect the typical reflex cabinet in a TV set or a radio, especially car radios, which have the 6x9 oval speakers in it. No longer do we do that really for stuff that's going to wind up being on MP3s or being distributed by electronic media, but we still do that for TV shows and things of that nature, so... There is actually a secondary mix that's made, and they try to make a decision between the raw stuff and the stuff that's going to be distributed, and it's like night and day. K2RW, K2J.
Roughly how much is cut back on the stuff that's distributed? I guess part of what's going on is you don't have anywhere near the same digital encoding rate, or depth of digits of dynamic range, and frequency response. So sounds to me like what gets distributed is what, one quarter of the number of bits that were originally recorded. Is a rough guess. Eric, go ahead.
All right, well, let's go back to the days when everything was distributed on CDs. CDs had a sample rate of 44.1 kilohertz, and there's a whole long story how that came about. And it's only 16 bits wide, which is pretty damn good, actually. That gets you a Nyquist of just about 22 kilohertz. And you don't want to be near Nyquist because it's kind of ugly looking, even after you filter it. Today, the more modern stuff is being recorded at 96 kilohertz, which gets you Nyquist at half of that, which is 48. Now my brain can't divide by 2. 96 divided by 2, that's 3, that's, I should pull out a calculator, I'm being stupid, sorry about that. And the depth will be 24 bits. Now there's a couple of different varieties of what they call high definition or high Q audio. Let me hit it drop again. If you're the real high-end audiophile and you want to spend the thousands of dollars on the speakers and the amplifier and the preamp and the device, there's a number of devices out there that are fully uncompressed that work at the 96 kilohertz rate at the 24-bit depth, and the audio is amazing, and they will actually release two different versions. One will be the standard mix, mixed down for the tiny little speakers for the wide distribution, and probably the original mix or a tailored mix that's based on the raw recording from the studio at the higher sample rate. Now, there is something called AC3 and 5.1 and Dolby SR and a bunch of other things, which are all forms of psychoacoustical compression, which is a combination of breaking up the audio into bands of frequency, doing something called run-length encoding, and also making a decision about what the human ear can hear. We don't realize it, but we do the same thing with video compression. We decide what the eyeball can see and what the eyeball can't see, and that gives us a reduction in the amount of data that we have to pass to reproduce that stuff. And MP3 and MP4 are based upon discrete cosine transforms and FFTs, and the HQ stuff is actually raw. Actually, there's a form of HQ which is based on one bit, and it's just a matter of how fast you turn the bit on and off. K2RW, K2J.
K2RY. RY, go right ahead.
Hello, Eric. This is David. You know, I have a turntable. Go through a preamp and an amplifier, through two XLR cables across the room into a DAC into my computer. So from LPs, I'm able to record 192 kilohertz, 24-bit audio, which can be played back from the computer back into the stereo, or through a FileX 5, which is a high-definition audio player. Do you know about these things?
Repeat that for me, Dick. Mr. RY, go right ahead and repeat that question for Eric.
QSL. Eric, you know, I have a turntable. It's pretty decent, made in Czech Republic. The output of the turntable goes into a preamplifier through an amplifier. And out of the preamp, it goes into two XLR cables that goes into a DAC. And from the DAC goes on to hard drive with software. And, you know, I record my LPs. I record my LPs at 192 kilohertz, 24-bit audio. And I can play it from the computer back into the stereo. And I can also play it through my portable HD player, which is called FileX 5. Do you know about these things?
There's actually a couple of different formats, and that's just one of them. Well, it's nice to be able to do that. It doesn't buy you anything because you're still dealing with an LP, which, you know, has its mechanical limitations, which is, you know, moving a needle up and down, Now, it isn't so much that your playback needle device is space full of files or wiggles in the groove. The real issue here is making the stamper and the master and the ability of the cutting head being able to reproduce that. So, an LP doesn't even get you 16 bits of it for resolution. So, the fact that it's 192 kilohertz, that's actually 248 kilohertz strength because it's stereo. So you're only just getting 48 kilohertz worth of sample. That's 24 bits, but you're getting two channels. That's why it's called 192. When you use your TV set, they're transmitting PCM as opposed to AC3. That stream rate is actually 192 kilobits per second, and that's really 244.1, or in the case of television, it'll be 48 kilohertz worth of sampling, plus a lot of some data stuff where there's headers on it to identify which channel, there's headers on it to say that this is AES, that XLR cables. I suspect in your case it's carrying analog audio, but we also use XLR cables, which actually at 110 ohm, believe it or not, to carry the PCM, which is 192 kilobits. So yeah, if that makes you happy, then all the more power to you, but you're really not gaining much.
QSL, QSL. Well, you know, I listen to MP3s, and I put them side by side with the recordings I make from the records, you know, and it's just quite an amazing difference. I like the sound of records, and also, you know, with Adobe or Audition, I'm able to pull the pops and ticks out of the imperfections out of the recordings. You know, and I don't know what else to say. It plays great when I'm walking down the street. Go ahead.
Now, well, again, if that makes you happy, then that's a good thing, because you're actually not, if anything, you're actually reducing the quality of the signal, especially if you're using little headphones and you're walking down the street. That's, you know, there's a limit to how you can move air based upon the size of the diaphragm. You know, what can I tell you? If you were to hear a raw recording from a real orchestra, let's say you're listening to Beethoven's Fifth, when there's a crescendo going on, there's a little triangle in the back, and you're listening to it by MP3 or MP4, and when you go to the theater and you hear that triangle, and you ask yourself, why don't I hear that triangle in the recording? That's because of the cyclocrystal compression, because of the large difference. Yes, with 24-bit recording of the raw stuff, you stand, you will hear it perfectly, but once you go to a compression scheme that is not a lossless compression, that triangle is going to disappear on you.
QSL, QSL, but I try to buy new vinyl and make perfect recordings first time around. So, you know, I get the best quality I can possibly get with this particular setup.
Well, consider this. When you get new vinyl, by the way, the vinyl is still the same as it was 50 years ago. The formulation hasn't changed much. The cutting heads are slightly better than they used to be, but they still suck. You know, after you play it the first time, you start to lose the high frequencies, and that's why you feel so good about when you get a nice new piece of vinyl, you put it on your really fancy turntable, and you record it, you've now preserved what the stamper has done for you. After that, it slowly degrades because you have friction, and you have a little needle that's actually wearing away the little variations in the groove, so... and actually, the way Dr. Peter Goldmark designed the long-playing record, the needle itself is not the point that actually picks up the vibration. It's the sides of the piece of diamond or the piece of sapphire that they're using. KQRW, back to you, K2J.
Many people really enjoy portability. Therefore, they're walking down the street or driving in an automobile or whatever, and they're using earplugs. And the diaphragm that's inside the earplug is obviously very limited in size. It's pushing an extremely small volume of air directly into your ear channel. So here I know nothing, and tell me anything you can, Eric, as to what kind of real quality can I get from your plug type reproduction as opposed to great big cup earphone-like things. Are there earplug-like sound reproducers that can do a decent job? KE2EJ, KQIW.
IW, KE2EJ. I'm just wondering about that technology has gone with leaps and bounds. You know, typical iPhone earbuds, as they call them, actually pretty good. The different formulations of Mylar that they use for the diaphragm, they have a number of different schemes in terms of creating reflex within the actual earpiece itself. You can actually get better results from some in-the-ear type transducers and get better results than you get from the big muffs on your ears. You know, everybody's got their secret sauce, and one's supposed to be better than the other. We're doing a lot better than we did, say, 10 or even 15 years ago in terms of the ability to reduce sound, but the one thing that you'll find is the better the reproduction, the less sound pressure there is, and they're not nearly as loud as what you can do with other devices. Because you're operating in a closed area, actually a very small volume of space, and how well the in-ear devices seal that, because you get leakage around the side of it, that prevents some of the back pressure from being there. But as a general rule, we've made lots of improvements, but if you want to do positional sound, which actually gives you more than just left and right, because we can simulate front and back and above and down by doing little phase tricks, you'll find that some of them have absolutely no ability to do it because they don't produce the same phase as what's being sent into them at various different frequencies. There's interaction.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We lost about 40 seconds of that, Eric, out of the 8.5 machine, although you were coming out of Selden pretty well. You mentioned the fact that earplugs are capable of producing not just left and right, but front and back, up and down. How in the world did they do that is one question. And second of all, I get the impression that to avoid the leakage around the side of the earplug, it's got to be literally designed for your particular ear geometry. So you just can't go out and buy one and assume you're going to get full performance. But when you do it all just right, what kind of frequency response and flatness can we get out of things that plug into our ears? Can I get 50 hertz to 15 kilohertz within plus or minus a dB or so? Is that possible? And once again, this up and down and left and right and front and back, how in the world do they do that? I'm not even quite sure how my ear does it. K2EJ, K2LAW.
WB2CUK with another query.
We'll get to you right after Eric's answer, Bill. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, K2LAW, K2EJ. Today we live in a world of DSP, and what we can do to simulate the concept of positional audio is based upon phasing. And there were studies done where they were actually took a human head and put microphones in them and really tried to discover how it works, so to speak, and its phase relationship. When you go into a theater, you go into a really well-tuned theater like Lincoln Center, when you go into Alice Tully Hall. Actually, depending upon the show, they will change the patterns of reflex and absorption electronically. There's these little panels that cover the ceiling and the walls, and they'll actually move based upon the production that they're doing. We have actually analyzed that and simulated that. But when you go to the movie theater and you see an action film, you don't realize that you're listening to 12 or 16 channels of audio sources coming at you, and it gives you the concept of it's coming from the left, it's coming from the right, it's coming from in front of you, especially some of the stuff that they made for 3D. It's coming from above you or below you, and it's really all phase relationship between the pair of ears. If you're only listening with one ear, you don't get that effect. It's the brain that's doing it for you. K2RW, K2J.
If I've got a set of things that are plugging into my ear that are high in quality and properly designed for the shape of my particular ear channel, what kind of frequency response can I get? Can I get a fairly flat response, 50 hertz to 15 kilohertz within a dB or so? Over to you, Eric.
Right, let me tell you that when you watch the guy on the news and you see that little tube coming out of his ear, he's got a little device that actually fits into his ear canal, which is kind of universal, and it's made out of little ribs, so that way it's sort of like a plug, and the transducer is external to the ear. It connects to that little tube. I'm sure if you've ever used a Plantronics headset that you're kind of aware of that type of setup. There's a company called Lectrosonic that actually makes a what we call an IFB receiver, which is actually used for the groups who are performing. You'll find most performers have something stuck in their ears so they can hear their vocals mixed at a decent level, and actually mutes a lot of the external noise, even though they're making a 100 dB worth of sound, and yet it acts in essence like an earplug, so to speak, to protect their ears. Those people will actually have the earpieces molded to their ear, whereas it's not just in the center of the plug, it's within the ribs of the external part of your ear, and it makes a perfect match. On those devices, I can guarantee you from 15 hertz to about 22 kilohertz being almost flat, well, being close to being flat. But for the general public, like your iPod earpieces or your Bose earpieces or Apple bought Big Bass, I forget the name of the company. Those have to be, A, not collecting earwax, B, universally be able to fit into everybody. So if you're a real audiophile and you really, really want to hear the truth, then you're going to have a custom molded earpiece made for you. And the transducer will be on the external part of your earpiece or...
Repeater, timeout. Peter, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, we lost the last 15 seconds that time, Eric. It came through Selden very nicely. Bill's got some further questions on the subject. WB2CUK, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, Jack. First, you ought to have the timer turned off. This is a very interesting subject here. And it seems like I'm talking with a lot of experts here for hearing how they're talking. So my knowledge is down in the basement somewhere as far as all this talk. But I would like to know why in the evolution of music, of playing back music and, from CDs to microchips, why they didn't come up with a turntable or use a laser drive, use a laser to scan the records. I can't figure out why they jumped from the analog right to the digital. Well, I never even heard of any prototypes or anything in popular science where they used a laser to read your albums. That would have been something I probably would have at the time spent $400 or $500 to have a turntable that would do that. And now they could probably make them a lot cheaper. But I don't know. What do you think, Dick? Do you think it's possible or just because the record is made that they really can't do it?
I'll sell you ones that cost about $18,000, but you can get them.
Yeah, if a laser is picking up what's on that vinyl instead of a needle that's wearing it out, and the laser is not wearing out the vinyl, boy, that sounds like a fantastic technique. I think you're saying, Eric, that that was developed, but it's very pricey and it never became popular. KE2EJ, be careful about timing out, Eric. K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm having trouble remembering the name of the manufacturer. It's a very high-end audio place. It's up in Connecticut, actually. My brother-in-law, who since passed, used to work for them. They make these really ridiculous turntables and CD players.
The prices start around $10,000-$12,000 the amplifier, something like $18,000. There's a, from what I remember, I think there's two manufacturers. I don't know if they still make them because I think one of the companies went bust, and I can't for the life of me remember the name of it, but it'll come to me at some point. And they don't work on every piece of vinyl, even.
2GS?
Roy recognized. I can see the problem of the way a needle moves left and right, up and down when it's pressing across vinyl. And unless you're very smart in the way you set up those lasers, the laser could behave a little bit differently. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Getting stereo out of it is a trick, too.
Yeah, supposedly there's a Japanese company called ELP that sold one at least back in 2015 for only $15,000, a veritable bargain. My last turntable had, I think, a laser, but it only worked to sense the grooves, so you could program it to play different tracks from the outermost to the innermost. You could set it anywhere, but I don't know. I think vinyl is a nostalgic item these days.
I'll bet you there are people, though, who just love the sound of vinyl, and almost any of the digital disc techniques, from their point of view, is a bit of a compromise. That's a guess on my part. KE2EJ for some comments. K2RIW.
G2 station that. You know, vinyl is only got maybe 15, 17, 18 dB of separation in vinyl because of the way the cutting head is. So that's one downside of vinyl. But yeah, there are people who really like the harmonic response that you get from moving magnetic coils, because that's essentially the way you're turning it back into a waveform. There were some cartridges that worked on capacitance and sort of like the RCA CD player, video discs from way, way back when. There are some other issues with it. If I can think of the name of the damn company, and they don't sell anything that's, you know, it's all custom made. And people actually buy it. So I mean, it's if you've got the whole system, you can spend like, you know, 20, 30 grand easily and be a very happy camper. And then when a stranger walks into the room, they can hardly tell the difference. K2RIW, K2J.
K2RY. All right, recognized, but BZ was ahead of you. W2BZ. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Have laser discs, movies come out on laser discs?
I think you're asking, Rich, were the movies that came out on laser discs? Was that your question?
Oh, it's a comment. I know there were. So how would that laser disc?
Okay, you said, how would that blank, blank, blank laser disc? W2BZ, K2RIW.
I try backing off your microphone. You might stay in there so we can hear you.
I'm sorry, guys. I just, this will be my last comment. There were laser discs, you know, in the Betamax days or right after the Betamax days, weren't there?
Even before there was Laserdisc, there was the RCA video disc, which was basically a grooved disc with a needle, and it worked by variable capacitance.
The disc, the size of LPs that were...
Alright, there's actually a couple of different forms of optical Laserdisc, and the RCA video CD, video disc. The pioneer version of the laser disc was actually it's the same thing as a CD. There are two different kinds. One was CAV, one is CLV, one is continuous angular velocity, and the other one is continuous linear velocity. The Japanese had another version of it, which was actually sort of high def at that point. The Pioneer laser disc looked like a disc, and I still have a whole bunch of them. Had a big hole in it for the spindle. The RCA capacitive video disc, where it actually becomes in a sleeve. You slide the sleeve into the player, it ejects the sleeve and leaves the disc inside. The needle actually pops down and fits into the groove. And whereas the laser disc, the different varieties of laser disc, there's no contact involved.
I'm having trouble. Southline, Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
By the way, Jim from Toronto said that the brand is Hafler, the American brand for the laser vinyl record player.
Was that familiar to you, Eric?
Yeah, they make real high-end stuff. There's another one, though, but that's one of them.
KG2LY. Go ahead, David. KG2LYW.
Sorry, guys. I disagree with you. I find that LPs, rock music, popular music, some jazz, some folk, certain recordings sound better on vinyl. And the rest sound better on CD. Classical sounds better on CD most of the time because you don't have the noise, the surface noise. But I think that LPs rock. And what's strange is that when I make a recording of a new record, you know, the record itself playing through the speakers sounds better than the 192 kilohertz 24-bit recording. But then, you know, you can play it back and it sounds flatter. The recording sounds flatter. But I do like the way records sound. And if you can play a new one into the recorder, you know, you preserve a lot of the quality. I don't know if records have more response than CDs, but I would think they do. Go ahead.
Sam, want to comment?
Let me ask him.
Eric, and then a second person. Eric first.
You might be a person that likes the color purple, and the next guy might hate the color purple. So what you're really talking about is your personal experience and your ears and your perception. Okay, from an electronic point of view, vinyl actually does not faithfully reproduce what you've recorded. Okay? 96 kilohertz, 24 bits, digital, does actually faithfully record whatever your microphone's hearing. So you're hearing what you like. It's like some people like tube amplifiers, and they hate transistor amplifiers. And some people love transistor amplifiers, and are kind of okay with tube amplifiers because it flavors what they're hearing. So you just happen to like that particular flavor. It doesn't mean it's better. It means you like it as opposed to the reality of if you actually look at it from an electronic standpoint. Whereas the digital recording of today's type of recording tells you the truth about what that sound was and how it was originally. And a raw recording without the sound engineer adding his flavor to it, because each recording has the sound engineer's flavor, how he likes to equalize the channels, how he likes to equalize the instruments, let me let it drop. How he likes to hear what he's got, how he likes to create the image between the two speakers, that is all personal. That is all the human response of that individual human being. So just because you think it's better doesn't make it better for someone else. That's what I got to say. KTYWK2J.
Yeah, but, you know, I do like it, and I like MP3s, and I like CDs, and I like just about everything. I like streaming audio. Go ahead.
And that's your opinion, and other people might not agree. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Who is the other person who wanted to make a comment? Give us your call letters and name. After the beep, K2LIW.
Evening, Dick. It's Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf, X-Ray Mike, Rich, with a comment. Eric kind of beat me to it. But leave us not forget the pleasing kind of harmonic distortion you get from tube amplifiers, and maybe the cartridge adds a little bit of that. I think it's even order harmonics, which will make the stuff sound really wonderful. But it is distorting, and that's the kind of distortion your ears kind of like, versus flat response, which you might not like as much. Whiskey Bravo to Golf X-Ray Mike.
Thank you, Rich. Anybody have any further comments on any of the above? Give me your call letters and name right now.
The E3, J-I-W Toronto. J-I-W Toronto.
Go right ahead, Jim. And let's find out what's the flavor most liked by the people in the Golden Horseshoe. You got it, Jim.
Well, in audio, most people are just buying the stuff, hooking it up, and play with it, what their ears. If it makes you smile, it's probably better. Remember a cover on one of the stereo magazines from the 70s? Can you really hear those hi-fi specs and comments that a mediocre amp can sound amazing and an amp with super specs sounds mediocre? You know, you can't really hear it, but you can still go out and buy stuff that is absolutely amazing. And Dick, you could do a whole night on transconductance, how the real impedance of a set of speakers can mess with an amplifier because the speakers are all over the place on their real impedance. And when you read reviews of $2,000 and $3,000 little amplifiers, you start realizing it's a slippery slope when you're after quality. But an expression I have, and I proved it to my nephew when he had a great Pioneer system, or Kenwood or whatever, and we bought a used NAD, November Alpha Delta, turned on, turned up, and I saw him smile. And then we went on the internet and found out that the NAD had 40 watts and the Kenwood had, quote, 120 watts. The NAD sounded better. I have an expression when I'm shooting the breeze with people reminiscing of what it used to sound like. There's an American Watts from Hafler NAD, Levingston, and there's Japanese Watts from the Yamaha Pioneer crowd, but audio is so much fun, and you could do a whole evening on the variable impedance of speakers and how it affects the loading of an amplifier. Same as how our antennas affects the amplifier loading when we are nowhere near, quote, 50 or 52 ohms. Back to net. Fun discussion. We're probably eating into AGS's time of his for his net.
Comment for that. Yeah, Eric, I'm going to add something to this. If you're using a solid-state or tube-type amplifier with a huge amount of feedback, you can make that amplifier deliver a voltage to that loudspeaker that looks like it's a milliohm of source impedance, and therefore it's forcing an exact voltage on that loudspeaker, regardless of the impedance of the speaker. I am guessing that may not be ideal, because in order to critically damp that speaker, it wants to see a particular resistive impedance and maybe even a reactive impedance. So to properly marriage the impedance of an amplifier to a particular speaker to get the best performance, I can guess that there's a lot of art and science right there. KE2EJ, K2RIW, be careful about the running over.
2RIW, K2EJ, you just started where I was going. We forget that the speaker is inductive, it's reactive, it's got an R, it's got an L, it's got a C, and it's different at different frequencies. So it's a combination of not only how you wind the voice coil, how the voice coil is suspended, how the ribs of the cone are mounted and suspended, and its counter forces actually change the reactance at different frequencies, and the speaker behaves differently. That's why you'll never find a speaker that when they sweep it and they actually look at it, it's perfectly flat, because it ain't. It's got little bumps and ridges, and that's what the speaker manufacturers try to overcome,
And that's what makes one speaker sound different from another. That's more complex than that, but there's a lot of mechanical engineering and acoustical engineering that goes into it beyond just the impedance and the match between the output of the amplifier and the input of the speaker or the sound reproduction device. K2RAW, K2J.
If I build an amplifier with a huge damping factor, in other words, an impedance at near zero, you would like to believe that that can damp a loudspeaker that's got a real good-sized magnet to it, very similar to what happens when you put a short circuit across a Dawson-Dahl meter. That meter becomes heavily damped. Is that the most ideal way to feed the speaker? Or if the amplifier presented a particular impedance at particular frequencies, does that make the loudspeaker perform better? KE2EJ, K2RAW?
That's a good subject on its own. If you want to think about public address systems and 70-volt distribution and actually taking a really low impedance, driving high voltage into a higher impedance, which is one of the things that's done in terms of mass distribution and stadiums and stuff like that. But when you talk about really high-end, expensive amplifiers, they actually sample a speaker, and there's a little microprocessor in there that takes that sample through a reference microphone, and it sends not only single tones but complex tones, analyzes it, and then tries to compensate for the mechanics of the speaker. But yeah, there's different schools of thought about how to approach that. That's why you'll find some reflexes that have two and three chambers, which try to flatten it out, especially at the low frequencies. But that's also the reason why you have a mid-range and a tweeter, because the mechanics are not capable of reproducing everything basically based upon the volume of air that it's moving.
I'm seeing a relationship here between the calibration procedure for a vector network analyzer. A vector network analyzer has got directional couplers trying to maintain a very constant voltage coming out of your source port, and the calibration procedure can grind back out the nonlinearities of the directional couplers, the nonlinearities of the test cables and the visoir of the connectors on the end of it and so on, and it can make that system flat to the nearest 60-some-odd dB. If I've got an ideal microphone in the exact right position of a loudspeaker, and I'm now feeding that back with a calibration procedure so that I now know what voltage the amplifier has to produce to that speaker in order to make the speaker flat across that frequency response. Has that taken place, that kind of calibration procedure on high-end systems so far, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
RAW, KE2EJ. Actually, that's fairly common, and the weak link to it is the reference microphone. When you buy a stereo, even a low-end stereo nowadays, it does 5.1 or 7.1, it will come with a reference microphone that you put wherever it is that your viewing position is or your sitting position is, and it will go through a whole series of calibrations at high, medium, and low frequencies to figure out to create the flattest response across the entire band off the position you are sitting, which also takes into account reflections and things of that nature. So what we can do with DSPs these days is pretty freaking amazing, I'll tell you that. K2RAW, K2J.
Pardon his French. So in other words, the reverberation of the room, the reflections of the room. In other words, if I've got a flat enough microphone during the cal procedure, and if I set that microphone exactly where my ears are when I'm sitting in my easy chair, you're saying I can normalize the speaker, the room, the rug, the drapes on the wall, everything. I can make that response at the position in three-dimensional space of my ears. I can make it nearly perfect for that one person sitting in that position, is what I think you're saying, Eric. And now, what do you do when you've got somebody else in the room you're trying to demonstrate the system to? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RY, KE2EJ. Well, the low-end stuff is a single-point microphone that you put in the chair that you you sit at. The really high-end expensive stuff, it comes with a fake head, which has two microphones in it, and an avid set of modeled ears. So, and you also have to put it at the correct height that you're sitting. So, you know, you can get ridiculous if you want, but yeah. Well, what we do in a studio control room is we will have we'll do it manually with a set of equalizers and phasing devices to flatten out that room to within reason. I mean, we could go nuts, but nobody does.
KG2RY, Rich, you wanted to make a comment on this?
KG2EJ from KG2RY. No, I have a question. You're talking about the most perfect digital recording, 96 kilohertz. How do we get our hands on it? Let's say I want to buy a certain record album. I want to get it in that format. How can I do it? You know how Apple Computer only gives you up to CD quality audio built in. You have to get external hardware to increase the resolution of the audio. Go ahead.
You got it, Eric.
Now, most computers, including, well, it depends upon whether you're talking iMac or MacBook, there's a IC manufacturer called Crystal that pretty much manufactures the audio chips for most PCs, which includes a DSP engine in it. And as far as they're concerned, up to this point, 48 kilohertz is the top end. Although the MacBook Pro, if you're doing Final Cut or you're doing editing, it will do 96 in the newer ones. But the audio quality coming out of those things is not questionable. It's reasonable, but it's not like you want to do something in high end. And one thing I got to tell you is that if it wasn't recorded at 96, there's no point in having 96, because now what you're doing is you're actually doubling up and you're doing averaging to make up those missing samples from the original recording. And that in itself creates a certain amount of harmonic distortion in itself, just like going the other way when you're decimating, which is another mathematical. We're really talking calculus here. So, you know, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you start with. What you really want is a S blank, a four-letter word that starts with S, the champagne converter, and I'm sorry, in reality, it really doesn't exist. QSL, QSL, I use the Apogee Duet. The signal comes in from the stereo, goes back out to the stereo, both at the same time. If I want to remaster a CD or a record or any source material coming from the stereo, I could do it on the fly. But, you know, more interesting, I guess, is that, you know, whatever comes out of the computer, if it's 96 kilohertz coming out of the computer and it's in my iTunes library, I can play it back up to 192 kilohertz, 24-bit, as you described it. So the quality is pretty good. So the question is, where can I get the source material? Well, since CDs are becoming a thing of the past, that's becoming harder and harder. Most distribution is done with MP3, MP4, AC3. Apple has their own, I can't think of the acronym for it. That's where you're basically, you're left with. Most studios record at 48. They tend not to record at 96 because that means they have to buy new gear. That means they have to buy a whole new studio. It's not just a console. It's all the processing gear along with it. It's an expensive proposition for a business. Don't forget, audio is a business, and they only do it to make money. And generally businesses, especially accountants, don't like to spend money. They expect to see money come in. So there are some groups that I can't think of the artist's name, but he was a force behind one particular HQ type of audio distribution in his little box. I forget what it is, but the file sizes are huge. and they take a long time to download. There is some, but they ain't a lot.
Kim says it was Neil Young. A Barnes & Noble bookstore on the Upper West Side, and they had some vinyl for sale there. And I looked and I saw some of the titles, like one from Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin 2. You buy the vinyl and they give you a password where you can download the digital version of that record. I think the record was remastered, however. I don't know, you know, if it sounds much different than the original one. But the download was at full, they say, 96 kilohertz resolution, so maybe that's one way to get them. But, you know, I got to really like the record if I'm going to put the money out for a record and the key for a digital download. Go ahead. Here's Led Zeppelin as an example, and I can guarantee you that none of it was recorded at 96, and that they're just doing up conversion. You know, how you hear it really depends upon your devices. Just because something is sampled at 96, don't forget, if you were to listen to it raw before it gets filtered, it has to go through a filter, okay? It actually goes through a Nyquist filter. And everybody's filter is different. It's the way they decide to make it. What you're doing is you're eliminating the quantizing steps between the digits, so to speak. That's a whole nother long discussion for another time, but again, if you like it, go for it. If you don't mind reaching into your pocket, go right ahead.
Rich, how expensive was that download when you pay for it? Go ahead.
I'm talking about the playback equipment in terms of expense. If we're talking about retrofitting a studio to run at the higher sample rates, then we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, it's like the Solid State Logic, the SSL, which is actually now owned by Peter Gabriel, a British company. Their 96 kilohertz console for a 36 input console runs around $300,000 in that neighborhood.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. WQVL repeater system.
Yeah, the question I'm trying to ask though is, if the private consumer wants to download 96 bits of a particular piece of music that he really likes, what is he likely to pay for that for that process?
Same as movies. You're buying the license to that particular piece of music. You know, it's probably $18 or $20 or whatever the album costs, and as a perk, you get a password to download another version of it, so it's usually no additional cost.
Eric, thank you very much for your explanation. KG2RY.
So apparently these RF guys that meet at the TechNet consist of a significant number of real audio files. A bit amazing. Okay, we're at the time. We really should go over to the science talk. AC2GS. Roy, I know you've got some real good subjects tonight, so go right ahead. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I got a quick question for you.
Go ahead, Eric.
I got a couple of these MFJ mobile antennas, and they don't work. And I'm looking at the base of them, and they appear to have like a 6 to 8 puff capacitor in them, and I'm thinking there's something in them that's open. So, what do you think?
Yeah, for a man of your resources, Eric, you could put that antenna on a vector network analyzer. It'll give you a pretty strong clue as to what's going on. If that impedance adjusting capacitor in the base became an open circuit, there's ways you could tell that. Although, a design that has a series coupling capacitor right at the antenna, or the capacitor you've got inside the rubber duck of the Waxon radios, boy, is that a troublesome thing when that breaks away. So I don't have an answer for you, but I think you have a way of collecting more data that'll give you a hint. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I do. And yeah, I put her on the VNA, and one of them shows absolutely nothing. It's just, you know, the return watch is forever. And the other one is frequencies are way, way different. And they, you know, if I look at it from an SWR point of view, it's like 3 to 1. There's something wrong with them. And then I put a capacitance meter on the base, and that's where I get like 4 puffs, 3 puffs, and I'm saying, I figure out the induction to the rod itself and the little coil into it, and of course it's got some more capacitors and to deal with the multiple frequencies, but I'm thinking the base has got some kind of an issue, and I don't know what's in it because I can't take it apart.
You can't take it apart because it's padded or there's some kind of a structure around it, Eric?
The base unscrews from the tilt-over part of it. That I can do, but I can't get the base open. I think what I have to do is do it destructively. You know, I mean, they're old, so, you know, you can see there's plenty of aluminum oxide around them, so, you know, maybe I should just take a blowtorch and heat it up, and maybe that'll loosen it up.
If you're lucky enough to have multiple of these antennas, it looks like it's going to require at least the destructive dissection of at least one of them to find out what's going on in there.
I've got two of these MFJ antennas. One failed, and then about 6 months later, the other failed. So, you know, I'm at a loss.
These are 2 meter antennas. We're being fed with 50 watts.
What I have in my hand is a 200 watt dual band mobile antenna. I don't know. I mean, because they're made out of aluminum, this one has SO239 in it. The aluminum oxide makes really good glue.
200 watt mobile antenna, which was mounted on a vehicle, so it listened to it. It got subjected to the salt spray, heat and cold of summer and winter and whatever on your vehicle. Is that part of what it went through, as well as 200 watts going into it?
Oh, I've never had 200 watts going into it. The most it ever had was 50 watts, but yeah. It's been all over the country with me, but and actually it got so welded to the socket, which I think is a different kind of alloy. I mean, I had to heat the thing up and really, you know, twist it off with the hope that I wouldn't tear the bottom of it off, which I actually did on one, and eventually I cut it out from the bottom of it. But because I looked on the internet, and it doesn't seem like anybody's ever bothered to take one of these apart.
Okay, sorry to say I don't have a clue from the evidence given to us so far, Eric. AC2GS with Science Talk, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. I just wanted to wrap up a few little things. It was, I think, Neil Young had a Pono player. That was a high-quality audio. And Apple had their own Apple Intermediate Codec AIC. That's their high-quality codec. Also, for the Science Talk, once again, the email address, if you want to contact me, if you want to suggest a topic, ask a question, refute what I said, what have you, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, I already have a few things linked to this this week. And by the end of this little pack, I will have the rest of it all linked and available for you to check out the web pages that address the subjects that I'm going on tonight. Let me break. First off, I have a few YouTube videos that might be of interest to some of the people listening. I placed a link on the webpage, roy.ac2gs, to a YouTube entitled The Scientific Method, which is a good explanation of the basic methodology science uses to winnow down the blind alleys and find paths of knowledge closer to the way that the universe's idea of doing things works. In addition, I also have a link to the entire series that particular video is part of. It's called History of Science, and much like science itself, this is a work in progress and not yet finished. When last I checked, they were only up to the 16th century, so there's a lot more science history left for them. Break. So I was suggest that you check out these series one of these days when you have the time. And for those who might want an entire physics lecture series, from astrophysics all the way to thermodynamics and everything in between, I also have a link to a gentleman. He's an astrophysicist by the name of Michael Van Biesen. If you miss anything, you can play it back. There's no test, and he covers almost everything in college and probably